Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Kilmore McCulley, who is the author of Pioneer of the Homocysteine Theory. And Dr. McCulley is actually the father of homocysteine. He's the original researcher that connected it to problems with metabolic issues in terms of heart disease, cancer, and even aging in his book. And homocysteine, I have known for a long time that homocysteine held a key to many of the degenerative diseases that we see due to a poor diet in the American and European ranges, the basic degenerative diseases that we have to deal with on a daily basis in medicine probably have a common etiology that homocysteine is involved in. So I'm very pleased to have Dr. McCulley today to tell us his story and the story of what the past information on homocysteine and what information for the future homocysteine may reveal to us about the consequences of our poor diet and lifestyle. Thank you, Dr. McCulley, for joining us.
It's a pleasure to speak with you and your listeners.
So, would you like to give the listeners a little bit of your background? You started off at Harvard Medical School and became a researcher, and you had a little bit of a snag there for a little while because people didn't believe that homocysteine was important. Would you like to go through that a little bit?
Sure. Well, I'm a farm boy from the Midwest, and my parents were pioneers. My grandparents and parents were pioneers in South Dakota and Wyoming. But I was born in Nebraska and grew up in Colorado. But I got to Harvard as a freshman in 1951, and I had been inspired by reading a book called The Microbe Hunters by Paul de Kruijf, which describes some of the great investigators of the 19th and early 20th century in uncovering the cause of disease. And I determined that that would be a an interesting and worthy career to pursue. When I went to Harvard in 51, I majored in chemistry and then went to Harvard Medical School, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And following medical school, I decided to apply for a position as a research associate at the National Institutes of Health. One of my professors at Harvard in chemistry called a colleague of his and got me a position in a laboratory. And it was the first contact that I had with sulfur amino acids and homocysteine. This Dr. Cantoni was an important scientist in the mid-20th century who discovered an important derivative of methionine. And the 2 years I spent there were devoted to basic research, and I felt that this is what I wanted to do with my life. And after that, I spent a year at the Massachusetts General Hospital studying molecular biology with Dr. Paul Zamysnik, and then I spent a year in Scotland studying molecular genetics with Professor Pontecorvo. And when I came back, I started in the laboratory of James Watson at Harvard, of Watson and Crick fame. And I studied with him for several months and then decided that I was getting too far from medicine and diseases, which I was interested in. So I decided to become a pathologist, and I studied pathology at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Mm-hmm. And it was after that that I ran across, after I finished my training at Mass General Hospital, I received a staff position there, and I encountered these cases of this new disease called homocystinuria. These children excreted this sulfur amino acid in the urine, and it built up in the blood plasma and caused some very interesting abnormalities, which I became fascinated with. And as a result of this, I encountered an archival case from 1933 of a child, an 8-year-old boy, who was mentally retarded and had dislocated optic lenses in his eyes, and it came in and with coma and signs of a stroke. And when the child eventually died, and when they analyzed the autopsy findings, he had developed a thrombosis of the carotid artery, which caused a massive stroke of the brain, which killed the boy. This case was discovered years later by Mary Efron and Vivian Shee, who were pediatricians at Mass General, who were interested in amino acid metabolism. And they had a child, a 9-year-old girl with this interesting new disease, with, again, dislocated lenses, mild mental retardation, and some skin changes. And in speaking with the mother of this child, they said, well, that this child had an uncle who died of a similar disease in the 1930s. So this case was actually published as a clinical pathological conference in the New England Journal of Medicine, and they were the ones who found this case. But when I heard about it, I became intensely interested in this because of the I could not see any connection between the thrombosis and vascular disease and this abnormality of homocysteine metabolism that that I had read about. So when I restudied the case, I was able to find some of the original materials, the protocol and some of the slides and a small amount of tissue from that 1933 case, and I confirmed all the findings that Dr. Tracy Mallory had described. And his diagnosis in the case was arteriosclerosis of the carotid arteries with thrombosis and stroke. So I became very interested. And then, fortunately, about 4 months later, a second case of homocystinuria was discussed at the human genetics rounds that I was attending. And this was a 2-month-old baby boy who had come in very desperately ill and with pneumonia and failure to thrive. And when they analyzed the urine, they found homocysteine in the urine. They also found another amino acid, cystathionine, and also methylmalonic acid. And it was apparent that this disease was caused by a different inherited enzyme defect than the classic case that I had studied from 1933. So when I looked at this second case, I found the protocol that had been filed away and forgotten, and there was no mention of the arteries. So I was sort of crestfallen, but I went back to the laboratory and I found the materials from this baby boy, and I restudied this case intensively, and I discovered that this child with this new disease called cobalamin C disease, which is a defect of vitamin B12 metabolism and methionine synthase deficiency, this child had really advanced arteriosclerosis at the age of 2 months, and it was just amazing to see this discovery. I was extremely interested in this and felt that it was a highly significant finding, and I then published these cases in my first paper on homocysteine and published in 1969. That's how it happened.
So, Dr. McCulley, did you ever see any cases where there was high homocysteine in the urine and the people or the children or the adults did not have this arteriosclerosis?
This question has come up. There have been large series of studies, one published by Harvey Mudd and his colleagues at the National Institutes of Health, studying a large number of cases, about, I think, 500 or so cases from around the world. Mm-hmm. And there are cases of individuals with homocysteine excretion who seem to live a normal life into their 50s, but they have a significantly shortened lifespan, and many of them develop vascular disease, like aortic aneurysms, myocardial infarction or heart attacks, or strokes. And their lifespan is significantly shortened.
And probably they don't know when they developed the problem. Is that right? I mean, they don't know that they had it as a child.
That's correct. And subsequently, the pediatricians have developed a screening test for this disorder in which they screen the urine of newborn children. And they have very accurately determined how many children are affected by this genetic disease. And it's a very small amount. It's around 1 per 100,000. And different populations have different incidences, but it's quite a rare disease. And so in my original paper, I discussed the possibility that that elevation of homocysteine would be of significance in normal people in the population without these rare diseases of homocysteine metabolism. And that subsequently has proven to be true.
And back then, you probably didn't realize how common these metabolic defects are. You know, the MTHFR defects, that's relatively recent.
That's correct.
We didn't realize that. I mean, I went to medical school in you know, 76, and we never heard anything about that.
That's right. Well, actually, the MTHFR, the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase enzyme, is the deficiency of this enzyme is the third major type of homocystinuria. The classic one, the classic deficiency, is cystathionine synthase deficiency. That was true of this child from 1933.
Right.
A much more uncommon one is cobalamin C disease, which is a methionine synthase abnormality. Mm-hmm. And the one you mentioned, the MTHFR disease, is fairly common in the population, although most people don't realize that they have it until they do the proper genetic testing. And it's interesting that a case of this MTHFR disease, the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase disease, was published from Chicago in 1976, and they discovered arterial plaques identical with what I had described in my first two cases that I published in 1969. So in all three of these rare enzyme defects, the elevation of homocysteine produces arterial plaques.
Well, you probably, I emailed you that I see patients ill from silicone, and what I'm finding is if a patient doesn't get ill right away because of an HLA genetic type that can't take exposure to silicone, the majority of what I'm seeing now, when the implant starts to leak, which is often 8 to 15 years later, the majority of these patients have MTHFR. And they also often have high homocysteine. So I routinely check for homocysteine because, of course, we're doing explantations here in an outpatient surgery center. We need to know that they're not at risk for heart attack and stroke.
Absolutely. Well, in the early days when I started in this field, the blood test was not available. You know, there was no good way of measuring homocysteine. But then scientists around the world then began to realize how important this was. And so now we do have a very convenient blood test that measures the level of homocysteine in the blood. And one can, as you've done, assess the risk for vascular disease in various conditions like the silicone implants and other many other conditions where the homocysteine becomes elevated.
Mm-hmm. And methylation is absolutely very important in detoxification. So if these people are exposed to environmental toxins and they have this MTHFR defect and don't take supplements that like MSM that help with methylation or CME and don't know that they have it, and then they end up without B12 and folate that they can use, even if they take supplements, sometimes the methylated, if you don't take the methylated supplements, then what they end up with is a much higher risk of problems because of heavy metals and chemicals and whatever else. And I think you would agree with me. We don't know that much about what these toxic chemicals over time do. If you study toxicology, you know what, if you get a big dose of the chemical, does to you. That's what's in the literature. But what if you just get a small dose of these chemicals, like, say, coming out of your breast implant over time? I mean, what's going to happen then? You know, it's unknown.
Well, that's an excellent point. As a matter of fact, you mentioned the SAM. That's adenosyl methionine. This is the compound that was discovered by Giulio Cantoni, who is the mentor I worked with at the National Institutes of Health. So I learned from the hand of the masters. The other interesting feature, well, and he showed that this compound is the coenzyme that methylates a huge variety of compounds in metabolism, proteins, nucleic acids, neurotransmitters, and as you mentioned, toxins that are absorbed into the body from the environment. This adenosyl methionine is the master methylator in the body.
Right. So, you know, we know very little about practical clinical toxicology. There is, you know, toxicologists out there that study industrial exposures and everything, but I think it's just absolutely amazing that we have been putting implants in women's bodies and not realizing that if they do have a, you know, a genetic defect or a problem with metabolism, methylation, whatever, that they could very much get ill very quickly.
That's right. The genetic background of metabolism is very important in susceptibility to toxic reactions from toxicants that are present in the environment.
Well, let's go back to homocysteine and heart disease and strokes and just in general arterial peripheral vascular disease. You know, in your book you mentioned that, you know, the different players in this have been homocysteine, possibly lipids in some cases, possible infections. You've listed a good number of different infectious agents that have been studied. And so give your, I guess, ideas about what is happening when a vessel occludes with an arterial plaque.
Well, this is a topic that I have studied over the years, and over the years, various pieces of the puzzle have been added, and fairly recently, beginning about 20 years ago, it became apparent that various infectious agents are involved in the process. One of the most prominently studied is Chlamydia pneumoniae, which is it's an intracellular parasite, and it's fairly commonly distributed. It's the respiratory chlamydia in opposed to the venereal disease or the eye trachoma agents. This respiratory chlamydia is very prominent in the population. It's actually been cultured from plaques, and it's been identified by electron microscopy, by immunohistochemistry, and by hybridization and various other molecular techniques in plaques. So the question is, well, what is the significance of this? And with my colleague Ofe Ravenskopf, we have developed a new hypothesis about how all of these factors come together to produce the so-called vulnerable plaque in the arteries. A vulnerable plaque is like an abscess in the lining of the artery, and when it ruptures, it causes thrombosis, and this is what produces a heart attack if it's in a coronary artery, a stroke if it's in the carotid artery or a branch, or an amputation if it's in the peripheral femoral artery or another peripheral artery. So the question is, how does this develop? And it was discovered almost 80 years ago that lipoproteins interact with microorganisms to cause inactivation. This has been studied by many different research groups over the years. And so these form aggregates between the microorganisms and lipoproteins. Now, in my work with my colleagues in the homocysteine research, we discovered that an active form of homocysteine called homocysteine thiolactone, the very reactive anhydride, reacts with the LDL of the blood. The low-density lipoprotein carries cholesterol, and it causes aggregation. So what we have hypothesized is that these aggregates composed of microorganisms, lipoproteins, and homocysteine become trapped in the small blood vessels that feed the wall of the artery, the so-called vasovasorum. And if these aggregates become large enough, they occlude these vasovasorum. The other interesting thing is that homocysteine elevation causes what's called endothelial dysfunction, that is, swelling and vacuolization of the endothelial cells. So a combination of the endothelial dysfunction from homocysteine, the high pressure in the wall of the artery, and these aggregates become trapped in these vasovasorum and cause a lack of blood flow or ischemia to the wall of the artery and cause a devitalization of the wall of the artery. This leads to hemorrhage, it leads to new blood vessel formation, and to thrombosis, and also the deposition of cholesterol and other lipids in the plaque. So the plaque, as we envision it, is like a microabscess that involves the intima. And this is our hypothesis as to how all of these factors interact and contribute to the formation of the so-called vulnerable plaque in the arteries.
So there are some lifestyle factors that have been known for a while. Smoking, probably because of the toxins involved. Hypertension, because theoretically you're beating up the insides of the arteries. Diabetes, you can explain that better than I can, the glucose effect on the small vessels. And then the thing I really loved when I saw it in your book is stress. You make the direct connection that when somebody is very, very stressed out and very angry, that their homocysteine levels go up.
That's right. This work was done by Catherine Stoney from Ohio, and she was subsequently at the National Institutes of Health. And she did some very nice psychological experiments in which they demonstrated that stress or internal rage causes the homocysteine levels to go up. And the other factors that you mentioned, like smoking, hypertension, things that we know predispose to vascular disease, all of these factors have been demonstrated to elevate the homocysteine level in the blood. And so now homocysteine elevation is accepted by the medical establishment as an independent risk factor for vascular disease. This is well established by hundreds of different studies.
And I think it's a shame because there are nutritional fixes for homocysteine problems, that homocysteine's not included on every physical exam that one gets after they're about 45. I mean, you would think that would be standard.
Well, the American Heart Association has weighed in on this, and they feel that it should only be measured if there's a suspicion. I agree with you. I think it should be a part of every examination because it's a much better indication of vascular disease and a measure of longevity than blood cholesterol. Blood cholesterol is very complicated, and the homocysteine measurement is a much better way to assess the long-term outlook in vascular disease and many other diseases. You mentioned diabetes. Diabetes is frequently associated with kidney failure, and hypertension is also. And it's been found, it's been known for many years that kidney failure is a very potent way to elevate blood cholesterol. And patients with kidney failure frequently die of vascular disease, either stroke or heart attack or amputation. And so this is a very clear connection. The other very important factor is hypothyroidism. Hypothyroidism is fairly common in the population, and it does lead to elevation of the homocysteine and may explain why people with hypothyroidism have increased risk of vascular disease. There are over 200 or more conditions that are associated with elevation of homocysteine and an increase in vascular disease. Some other examples are various drugs, some anti-folate drugs and other anti-nutritional or anti-metabolic drugs will elevate homocysteine and lead to increased risk of vascular disease. You mentioned the B vitamins. It's been known for many years that the three main B vitamins of pyridoxal or vitamin B6, folate or B9, or cobalamin or B12 are the key vitamins that control the homocysteine level. They are not the only controls, but if they are deficient, then the homocysteine goes up. And, for example, in vegetarians who have a very low vitamin B12 intake, they frequently will have an elevated homocysteine for this reason.
Yeah, so B12 injections or sublingual or something is very important. And it's also known that as you get older, you don't tend to absorb B12 as well from your gut, so you can't rely on dietary sources or even oral supplement sources of B12.
That's correct. That's also true of the other vitamins, too. People don't realize that vitamin B6, for example, absorption declines with aging, and absorption of other nutrients declines with aging. So aging is correlated with poor utilization of these B vitamins. And so it makes sense for people over the age of 65 or so to take supplements to increase the levels to compensate for this loss through the aging process. The other The other point I wanted to make is that food processing, the ordinary methods of food processing, like canning, like extraction of sugars, extraction of oils, milling of grains, addition of chemical additives, all of these traditional methods of food processing that we've become accustomed to for 200 years or so have caused a very significant loss, especially of vitamin B6 and vitamin B9, folate and pyridoxal. And this may have contributed to the precipitous rise in vascular disease that occurred in the mid-20th century. Mm-hmm. And since then, since about 1958, there's been a very significant decline in the mortality from vascular disease. And in my first monograph, I analyzed some of the reasons for this and concluded that actually fortification and supplementation may have contributed to this decline in mortality from vascular disease.
Yeah, the folic acid was added primarily to prevent neural tube defects. I mean, that was the reason that they said that they were doing it. There's no doubt that it helped vascular disease, though. Except, though, if you do have the MTHFR, you don't need folic acid. You need methylated folate and methylated B12. And that's, you know, that's something that I think most traditional doctors don't realize, that they have to supplement with what they need, not folic acid. Folic acid is actually pretty toxic to them.
It's a synthetic precursor of methylfolate, and it's interesting that fairly recently these methylated derivatives have become fairly widely available to take. Mm-hmm. They have been available for some time, but now they're much more available. So one can buy methyl tetrahydrofolate, for example, or the methylfolate that you mentioned, or methylcobalamin. And these are much better. These are the normal or the natural forms of the body, of the vitamins that circulate in the body. So these are highly active and much more effective, as you point out, than folic acid.
I'm looking at a product by Ortho Molecular called Methyl CPG. It has riboflavin, vitamin B6, only 50 milligrams, though, that's not a lot, methylfolate, and methyl B12. But what's interesting about this supplement is my patients don't do well if they take it every day. They do much better if they take it twice a week, if they weigh over about 125, and once a week if they weigh less. So what we're finding in at least this clinical practice is that you don't give this every day.
Isn't that interesting? Have you measured their homocysteine levels? I'm sure you have.
Well, I get a picture of them when they come in, but most of my patients are from out of state, so I haven't followed them. But, you know, I probably should tell them that they need to, if their levels are elevated, that they need to, you know, make sure they come down. But I think the reason they don't feel well is that the folate, too much folate may feed the viruses they have. Almost all of them, because they have a T-cell immune defect, have multiple different viruses that make them feel bad, you know, the chronic viruses. And so if we give them too much folate, then the viruses kind of take off and they feel poorly. We're still working all this out. This is really the cutting edge of this medicine. We're just playing around with this stuff, and we found that if we give it every day, they don't do well.
Isn't that interesting? One of my colleagues, Olaf Stanger, is a surgeon from Austria, and he has also studied the same effect. And I believe that these microorganisms that you mentioned, the viruses like cytomegalovirus or herpes virus or other viruses, have been implicated in plaque formation. And I believe that they have an important role in affecting the metabolism of the cells of the arteries. And as you say, they can deplete folate, or they can deplete this other compound that I've been working with, this thioretinico complex that is important in oxidative metabolism. These viral agents can deplete these within the cells of the arteries and lead to, as you say, deleterious effects.
Well, that brings us to the next topic, which is fascinating, which is the role of homocysteine in cancer, because as you so aptly pointed out, that Warburg in the, I think, 1930s found out that the thing that was common to all cancers is a disruption of oxidative metabolism.
Correct. It's so-called aerobic glycolysis. In other words, the production of lactic acid in the presence of oxygen. This reaction was originally discovered by Louis Pasteur in the 19th century. It was called the Pasteur reaction. He studied yeast, and he found that if he introduced yeast into his introduced oxygen into his yeast cultures, that then the lactic acid production declined. And what Warburg found was that cancer cells have a very specific abnormality of this reaction, and the oxygen doesn't affect the lactate production. So they go on producing large quantities of lactate in the presence of oxygen. I became very interested in this some years ago when we were studying cell cultures from our children with homocystinuria. We made a discovery of a new pathway of sulfate synthesis from homocysteine using these cultures. And a couple of my colleagues at Mass General, when I was there, gave me cancer cultures. And I studied the homocysteine metabolism in these cancer cells in culture and discovered a very specific abnormality of homocysteine metabolism. They were unable to convert the sulfur atom of homocysteine into sulfate. And as a consequence, the cancer cells accumulate this highly reactive form of homocysteine called homocysteine thiolactone, which mm-hmm. then reacts with the amino groups of the proteins, nucleic acid, and glycosaminoglycans of the cells and causes the widespread membrane defects, many of the protein abnormalities, and the genetic expression abnormalities, and in addition, may be responsible for this effect on oxidative metabolism. That is, mm-hmm. what I've theorized is that normal cells contain a substance which enables them to metabolize oxygen by oxidative phosphorylation normally, but in cancer cells, there's a deficiency. And in my research with my team over the years, we have determined that the vitamin A derivative of homocysteine thiolactone or thioretinamide forms a complex with vitamin B12 called thioretinico, and that this forms a complex that facilitates oxygen metabolism in normal cells. And this is, we have hypothesized that this is the compound that is missing in cancer cells. Mm-hmm. And very recently, we've added to this theory by adding the important coenzyme called nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, or NAD. This is a precursor of the ATP that is produced in oxidative phosphorylation. So this is the area of metabolism which is abnormal in cancer cells and gives us some clue as to the origin of why cancer cells cannot produce this material. And it turns out recent studies have shown that there are abnormalities of cystathionine synthase, the same enzyme that causes homocystinuria when it's abnormal, that has a heme oxygenase function. And in cancer cells, this heme oxygenase function is lost so that it interrupts the synthesis of this thioretinico. So this is sort of an outline of some of the discoveries that we've made in the cancer field.
And, you know, I'm going to say something as a surgeon here. We're never going to defeat cancer by killing cancer cells. You know, we've been trying to do that forever. We have to do something different. We have to, like you say, discover what's wrong with the internal metabolism of the cancer cell and do something to turn it around so that it can become a normal cell.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think you really hit the nail on the head. There's a very interesting theory of cancer called the trophoblastic theory of cancer. It was introduced over 100 years ago by John Beard, an embryologist at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. And he advocated the use of pancreatic enzymes for treatment of cancer. And it had a brief flare in the early 20th century. And it was a different approach, but it was sort of discredited because it failed so many times and was very hard to control. And it was then supplanted by what you're referring to as chemotherapy, radical surgery, and radiation therapy, which are now mm-hmm. the cornerstones of the traditional treatment of cancer. But he theorized that pancreatic enzymes, which convert the trophoblast into the placenta in the developing embryo, can modulate cancer growth. And so these potent enzymes from the pancreas of the developing embryo are capable of degrading or catabolizing the various molecules that are attached to homocysteine. When excess homocysteine is produced in cancer cells, these elastase, the nucleases, lipases, amylases, these very potent digestive enzymes can increase the metabolism of these homocysteine-related macromolecules. So it does suggest a new way of looking at treatment of cancer and even prevention of cancer?
Yeah, I think that there are rare, we don't know how rare, but rare cases where genetic defects cause cancer. The most obvious one is when somebody has no pigment. You know, a genetic defect of that doesn't have pigment, then they get skin cancers very, very easily. But in the majority of cancers, there tends to be, you know, so many different factors. There's all these infectious factors. They've found parasites, mold, viruses, bacteria, and they found radiation, even medical radiation, increases the risk of cancer. They found toxic chemicals. They found even geopathic stress increases the risk of cancer. So we have all of these things, but one thing is for sure is that cancer doesn't grow nearly as quickly in an alkaline environment that it does in an acid environment. And so it has to be a metabolic thing that connects cancer, I mean, that makes it cancer. It has to be metabolic.
Right. Well, this is area of metabolism has been intensively studied for many years by cancer researchers. And the Warburg effect is extremely important. And these findings that I have published give a new or a different explanation of the origin of the Warburg effect. And I think that further work may prove fruitful in this way.
Well, you mentioned in your book that you had patented a couple of molecules that came out of this research that could potentially have a benefit in cancer.
That's correct. This was a long-term process. My colleagues and I and my team synthesized about 35 new compounds containing homocysteine, and we treated animals with transplanted cancers to see whether it was an effect, and sure enough, we found this. And over the years, we then narrowed down our interest to this derivative of retinoic acid, which is the vitamin A. It's a normal vitamin A acid. And, of course, vitamin A is very critical in maintaining differentiation of cells and controlling cell metabolism. So this compound containing homocysteine and retinoic acid, which we call thioretinamide, is one of these patented compounds. And it counteracts carcinogenesis, it counteracts tumor growth, it also counteracts the production of arterial plaques in rats treated with homocysteine thiolactone. So this is one of the compounds, and I've attempted to encourage interest in the pharmaceutical industry in these compounds, but so far it has not succeeded. But I think it is a promising approach, and maybe future generations will use this approach and make it successful.
Well, I've interviewed a lot of the leaders in alternative cancer, including Nicholas Gonzalez and other, but just about basically almost all of the leaders. And I really feel that there are some very significant political roadblocks. You know, like Ralph Moss found within the institutions that basically come down to the fact that when anything really is looking that it would be beneficial, like vitamin B17, I believe, Laetril, and the enzymatic therapies that Nicholas Gonzalez said that were not done correctly by the NIH. It seems like every time they do a study, they deliberately sabotage it.
Well, the cancer industry and the cholesterol cartel have a huge vested interest in maintaining the status quo, and so any successful new therapy like this will be greeted with derision. Until it's absolutely proven that that the traditional therapy is insufficient.
Yeah, so I think not unlike the breast implants thing, where they're perfectly safe. You know, they don't cause any problem whatsoever. They don't even get infected. You know, it's the only foreign body out there that never gets infected. You know, according to most mainstream doctors, I think it's amazing. But
You mentioned Nicholas Gonzalez. He mm-hmm. and Linda Isaacson have really resurrected this approach of John Beard that I mentioned before. It's mm-hmm. an extremely interesting approach, and he claims to have had some success with it. And as you mentioned, he did a trial that was sponsored by the National Institutes of Health, and this was basically sabotaged, as he explained in his recent book. And there are vested interests that are interested in keeping the status quo. And actually, this happened to me. You know, when I first started publishing my work in the 70s, my position at the Harvard Medical School and at the Mass General Hospital was jeopardized because the elders at Harvard didn't feel that homocysteine research was promising. And so I was forced out, and I was actually unemployable for about over 2 years until I turned to some legal help and managed to secure a position at the VA hospital in Providence. But so I had an encounter with the establishment, and there are powerful economic interests that want to maintain the status quo.
Absolutely.
And inhibit the search for the real answers to diseases.
That's true. My cousin is Dr. Doug Wallace, who is the father of mitochondrial DNA. You may have heard of him. And he was similarly falsely accused and forced out of Emory. He ended up winning that lawsuit, but he left and took his team up to Pennsylvania. But I can say pretty much that when somebody's doing really, really good work, it causes a lot of jealousy amongst scientists who are of lesser caliber. And frankly, some of these maneuverings that I've seen at Emory, I've seen at Hopkins, I've seen at other institutions through some of the people I've interviewed on this radio show, it's not uncommon to have really brilliant people who are doing good work sabotaged, often by their own institution.
Well, I think it was Schopenhauer said that new ideas are first greeted with derision, and then they're termed insignificant, and then finally, when the evidence comes in, they say, "Well, I discovered it before you did."
Right.
So there is.
We knew that. We knew that all along. You know.
We knew it all along. As you
That's
say, there's
right.
a lot of jealousy and rivalry.
There's a lot. I have observed it firsthand when I was at Hopkins. I was a research assistant in the endocrine and the renal division, and I had firsthand knowledge of what was going on there. Because it was going on right in the labs I was in. But
When I first started publishing my work on homocysteine in the late 60s and 70s, the attitude was that somehow maybe I didn't understand the cholesterol hypothesis, or somehow there was something wrong with me because, you know, why didn't I toe to the party line? Well, I wanted to point out that I learned at the hand of the masters. My professor at Harvard was Louis Fieser, who was a world-class organic chemist who specialized in cholesterol, and I also studied, and one of my mentors was Conrad Bloch, who won the Nobel Prize for cholesterol biosynthesis. So I had this background of knowledge, and that put my homocysteine work into perspective, and I maintain this perspective. Is certainly cholesterol is certainly an important, it's extremely important compound. You can't live without it. But the idea that it somehow causes a vascular disease by by damaging the arteries has been totally disproven
by experimental
studies and by the human studies, the Framingham study and other studies. So it is involved, and I think that this hypothesis that Uffe Ravenskopf and I have proposed explains how the lipoproteins and microbes and cholesterol conspire to produce plaques in the arteries. So
right.
I think we've come a long way from the original ideas in this field, and I think we're beginning to understand the basic pathogenesis of the disease.
Well, what I can see from my standpoint, you know, I don't put people on statins, obviously, as a surgeon, but they come in on statins, and I see that many of them are severely deficient in coenzyme Q10 and have the symptoms of it. And I even advised some doctors in the doctor's lounge who said they started statins and could no longer run, that maybe they needed some UBQH. But, you know, basically, if we lower cholesterol too low, what my colleagues are telling me is that we can increase the risk of cancer. So we need to be careful about how low we lower cholesterol.
Not only that, the Framingham Heart Study published a paper some years ago showing that those individuals who had their cholesterol lowered had an increased risk of vascular disease and a shortened life expectancy. And this has been duplicated by many different studies. As a matter of fact, the whole question of cancer and statin therapy that you mentioned has been examined by many people. And my colleague, Paul Roche and Uwe Ravenskopf and I weighed in on this controversy. And it's difficult to prove one way or another, but there are, as a matter of fact, there's a very interesting recent study that was just published from Japan and from the FDA in America showing that in 1.4 million people who were studied for the effect of statins, there was a significant increase in pancreatic cancer and colorectal cancer in this study. Other cancers were not significantly affected. And there have been many conflicting reports. Of course, statins have been implicated in producing cancer in animals in doses that are similar taken by patients. So it's a as you mentioned, it's a hazardous situation. The other recent findings are that it increases the risk of diabetes and also cognitive impairment, and as you mentioned, muscle damage and liver damage. And some of the recent the FDA has actually listed these complications as problems with statin therapy.
Right, right. And I did want to mention, because you've got a great chapter on this, the role of homocysteine elevation and aging. Would you like to comment on that a little bit?
This is an absolutely fascinating topic. It's a huge topic, but it was apparent from the studies of blood homocysteine that as you get older, the level goes up about 1 point every 10 years. So as you get older, the homocysteine level increases, and the question is, well, why? And so in some of my earlier reviews, I suggested that it's a gradual developing deficiency of this complex, this thioretinical complex, which supports oxidative phosphorylation. It's well known that in aging, you have an abnormality of oxidation. And this gave rise to the famous free radical theory of aging proposed by Denham Harmon. And so this approach explains why oxidative metabolism declines in aging. And very recently, a newly synthesized form of vitamin B3 called nicotinamide riboside has become available commercially through chemical synthesis. And in studies of aging at Harvard Medical School and also at Einstein in New York, they've determined that this form of vitamin B3, nicotinamide riboside, increases intracellular NAD levels. Mm-hmm. And they've determined that in the aging process, NAD is one of the things that decline. But what I've published very recently, it's in press actually, is a theory showing that the NAD is a precursor of ATP by this complex, this thioretinoguanosinide complex. So my concept is that these complexes decline in the natural aging process, and that by taking these supplements, one can delay or postpone the aging process. And it's a very exciting theory, and it has to do with the enzyme activity of the sirtuins. The sirtuins are acetyl-deacetylases that affect genetic expression in aging. So the NAD level controls these sirtuins. The other point is that in aging, one has, as I mentioned, the increased oxidation of proteins and nucleic acids that this may counteract. So here we have a kind of a general theory of aging that puts a lot of pieces to the puzzle together. And it may also explain why caloric restriction causes or delays aging. And so these are some ideas that I think are worth pursuing and may be fruitful in the future.
Well, that sounds wonderful. We've covered the major degenerative diseases that people die from, and then turned our attention to how we slow down aging in general. That's absolutely fabulous. So, we're coming up to the end of our hour. Would you like to give our listeners any words of wisdom?
Well, I'd like to encourage them to read some of my books. I published my first book, The Homocysteine Revolution, in 1997, and then my daughter Martha and I published a more readable version for the general public called The Heart Revolution in 2000. And these give the general outline of the theory of the homocysteine theory and how it could be used to improve health and increase longevity. And as you mentioned very recently, I published my scientific memoirs, The Pioneer of the Homocysteine Theory. This has been published by Nova Science last 2013, and it describes my experience in homocysteine research. So if your listeners are interested, they can read these books for themselves. They're all in print, and I've received calls and letters and emails from all over the country of people who've read these books and have used these approaches to improve their health. And it's very gratifying to me to find that that people have paid attention, have used this information to improve their health and to increase their longevity and improve the quality of their lives.
Well, I certainly agree with them. You have wonderful ideas in the book, and I'm going to do the same. I'm going to increase my daily intake of B6 and investigate some of these other ideas that you have in The Pioneer of the Homocysteine Theory. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
This has been Dr. Susan Kolb. We've been interviewing Dr. Kilmore McCulley. His most recent book, Pioneer of the Homocysteine Theory, is his memoirs of his life work in homocysteine. And then his book for the general public, that book, Dr. McCulley, is called The Healthy Heart. Is that right?
The Heart Revolution. It's called
The Heart Revolution. I'm sorry. The Heart Revolution.
Published
by Harper Collins. Yeah, that's probably the best one for the general public to get, because his book, The Pioneer of the Homocysteine Theory, is not light reading, I can tell you that. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us, and join us next week for Temple of Health Radio Show.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.